Well, let me turn to some examples of elastic and inelastic demands. In those cases in which a good has close substitutes, then if its price rises and there are ready substitutes at hand, we should expect that there'll be some significant reduction in quantity demanded at the higher price. This would tend to be an elastic demand. If you have good substitutes, then at a higher price, people have ready alternatives. A rise in price will tend to cause them to shift to other things. Similarly, if the good in question is an effective substitute for those other things, if its price falls, then it should make substantial inroads on the demand for them, and that would be an elastic demand. Again and again, goods that up to a point have been luxury goods, but are of a kind that practically everybody would like to own if they could afford them, well, such goods are likely to have an elastic demand if their price goes down. Because then, as the price goes down, the goods open up to a mass market. Some excellent examples. Early in the 20th century, the automobile was a high-priced luxury good comparable to what a decent-sized yacht costs today from the point of view of most people's earnings. And only a handful of automobiles could be sold under those conditions. But as the cost of production and price was sharply brought down, the market for automobiles expanded into the millions. So at the initially high price, early in the century, the automobile industry was a relatively minor industry. If you're only turning out a few hundred a year at $10,000 a car, that doesn't compare to selling several million automobiles at $300 a car. And so as the price of automobiles declined, the quantity of automobiles demanded radically increased, far beyond the decline in price, and the auto industry became a much larger industry. More recently, personal computers. When the personal computer began, it could be afforded only by a relatively small number of people, but as it improved and the price came down, the market enormously expanded, and so far more is spent in buying computers today than in years past, even though the prices are much, much lower. Now, by the same token, goods that have poor substitutes, when the price rises, people don't have anywhere else to turn, well, then this will tend to be an inelastic demand. It'll take a very big rise in price to have a significant reduction, to cause a significant reduction in quantity demanded. Goods that are necessities are in this category. If there are things that people consider they just must have, modest increases in price will not have any significant effect in reducing the quantity demanded. The increases in price have to be very, very substantial. Food items, gasoline, electric power, anything that is in the category of a necessity will have an inelastic demand. And when people are pretty well satisfied with necessities, then decreases in price have very little, conceivably even no effect, in expanding the quantity of those goods demanded. And of course, we dealt with unit elastic demand as the last subject, I think, before the break. That was the question raised by Mr. Zink, and its main application would be aggregate spending. Now, a few applications of the concept of elasticity. One application is the effects of machinery on employment. Sometimes you'll come across the argument that machinery causes unemployment. Other times you'll come across the argument that machinery causes employment. If we're looking at isolated industries, There are situations where labor-saving machinery will reduce employment in the particular industry in which the machinery is introduced. And there are other cases in which machinery, labor-saving machinery, will increase employment in the industry in which it is introduced, and which it does depends on the elasticity of demand. Roughly speaking, the extent to which labor is saved in the production of something sooner or later shows up in a corresponding reduction in the price of the thing. This isn't a perfect relationship by any means, but at least it prevails to a reasonable degree. If we can produce a good using half the total labor, that will operate to reduce its cost by roughly half and reduce its price by roughly half. If the quantity demanded of the good more than doubles at half the price, then the number of people employed as the result of the labor-saving machinery will be greater. And I think this was certainly the case in industries like the automobile industry, the computer industry. Only because we could produce a unit with much, much less labor could the item become affordable to a mass market, with the end result that far more people are employed than were before the labor-saving improvements. But then there are many cases in which labor-saving improvements and cost and price reductions will result in little or possibly hardly any or even no increase in quantity demanded. Suppose we could cut the quantity of labor required to produce a box of table salt in half. Do you think people would then salt their food more heavily? I wouldn't think so. They would very probably buy the same quantity of table salt at half the price. So what would be the effect on the number, on the amount of labor employed in the production of table salt? It would tend to be cut in half. But now, this would not mean, I hasten to add, that labor-saving improvements in instances in which the demand was inelastic, that they caused unemployment. Because what will people be doing with the money they no longer spend to buy these goods whose demand is inelastic and where fewer people are employed now?
Spend it on other goods.
They'll be spending it on other goods, and there'll be jobs equivalent to those lost opening up in other parts of the economy. So even when there are labor-saving improvements in industries confronted with an inelastic, even a perfectly inelastic demand, the effect is not to cause unemployment. It's to reduce the employment in that industry, but to free up people's funds to buy more of other things and expand employment opportunities elsewhere in the economic system. Now, another application of the concept of elasticity is in instances in which a firm is confronted with little or no competition. If you have a patented technology, a copyrighted formula, or a copyrighted book or a song or whatever, or a secret technology, and you're the only one in a position to produce a given item, and it doesn't have close substitutes, and it achieves some important purpose, or is very highly desired, well, in those circumstances, you may be in a position to exploit the elasticity of demand for the item. And you may be able to make substantially more money by producing a small quantity at a high price than a larger quantity at a low price. There are undoubtedly some life-saving drugs with patent protection that are in this category. It's conceivable that you could have certain pills that have a manufacturing cost perhaps of 10 cents per pill, and which are being sold at $5 per pill. Because if the price were reduced to correspond more closely with the cost of production, if the price went from $5 a pill, let's say, to 25 cents a pill or something like that, well, it's entirely possible that the increase in quantity demanded would not be remotely great enough to compensate for the reduction in price per unit. So it's to the advantage of the drug company, while it's patent protection less, to charge the much higher price. But if the patent protection is limited and does come off, well, when it comes off, then the price should be driven down by competition to reflect the underlying cost of production. And the justification for this kind of arrangement is that the existence or the fact that you can gain patent protection if you have a significant new advance and make stupendous profits for a limited time, that provides the incentive to develop the advances. And also, very importantly, the extremely high profits that are earned on such advances themselves serve as the source of financing for undertaking further advances. And so, while it's true that people are paying a stupendous price for some time, well, in the absence of that arrangement, they might not have had the advance at all, or subsequent advances. Now, apart from such cases, the fact that the demand for an item might be inelastic will generally not be of any benefit to the producers. We have inelastic demands for all kinds of things, but the producers are not normally in a position to exploit them. Consider how inelastic is the demand for spare parts. Just think what would happen to our ability to operate our automobiles if we couldn't obtain all kinds of different spare parts. Relative, very simple, cheap spare parts, like fan belts, nuts and bolts. Well, you couldn't operate your car, or it would be a great hazard to do so. Is your car operable without brake fluid? No. You'd be risking your life and those of anyone in your way. So for practical purposes, if you're going to operate a car, it's absolutely necessary that you have brake fluid. It's absolutely necessary that you have all of the different fan belts. It's absolutely necessary that you have a carburetor and all kinds of other parts. Well, how much conceivably would any individual buyer of such a part be prepared to pay rather than go without it? As much as he values the car. The whole utility of the car depends on the part, or the far greater part of the utility. And so the utility of the part is as great, or almost as great, as that of the whole car. Well, what does this imply about what the buyers of the parts are willing to pay if we array them all? If you think of everyone who owns a car, and how much everyone who might need a new fan belt, that all of these people value a new fan belt as highly as their car, where they value brake fluid as highly as their car, a quart or two of brake fluid, whatever it is, they value that as highly as their car. What kind of demand curve should we envision for things like brake fluid, fan belts, whatever? Imagine we have 10 million cars out that we have, well, we have far more, maybe we probably have over 100 million cars in this country, maybe more than that. Suppose we have 100 million cars ranging from new super luxury cars down to old rattle traps. And let's assume the oldest rattle trap on the road, it's probably worth at least $500 if it operates, something like that. And everyone who needs a replacement part values his part as highly as his whole car. And if the marginal car is worth $500, what should we expect the marginal buyer of a fan belt or brake fluid or anything else necessary to the car to be willing to pay if he had no alternative? Up to $500. So you would think, well, the potential is there for fan belts or the brake fluid changes to go for $500 a pop. That's what they would go for if their price were determined by the demand. And that's what they could go for. Imagine the government decided to impose excise taxes on any of these things. Suppose the government decided we want to collect money from people rich enough to drive cars. We'll use it for the environment or God knows what. We'll impose an excise tax of $100 on every brake fluid change. Now, how many fewer brake fluid changes do you think there'd be?
A lot.
A lot? Well, I mean, people might extend the intervals somewhat, but there'd be some. It could end up the effective cost of owning a car would be $100 higher. That would bring about some reduction. But if you were to look at the gross revenues of the sellers of brake fluid pre-passing on the excise tax to the Treasury, what do you think would be the effect of this $100 per brake fluid change additional charge? Do you think the revenues? Pardon me?
There would not be a large effect.
There would not be much change?
Oh, manufacturer had it sold?
Let's say whether it's the manufacturer. It depends how they would impose the tax, whether it's the manufacturer or the service station owners. We have the same situation, a real life such situation, with cigarettes. There's a tremendous excise tax on cigarettes. Now, what do you think happens when the government increases the excise tax on cigarettes, at least up to now, where it's gotten to its present level?
There's some reduction in smoking or not?
There's some reduction in quantity demanded, but do you think the reduction in quantity demanded remotely approaches the rise in the cost of buying a pack of cigarettes?
No.
No, it doesn't, and it wouldn't in the case of brake fluid or fan belts or anything of this kind. These are inelastic demands, and the amount of money spent to buy these items would be very sharply higher at these higher prices. They're extremely inelastic demands. There's very little drop-off in quantity demanded at the higher prices. Now, the price will go up when the government imposes a tax, because then everyone who's offering it must pay the tax if he wants to operate legally. But ask yourself, if the total revenue goes up when the tax is imposed, why are the companies waiting for the tax to be imposed? Why don't they raise the price themselves before, without a tax, and pocket the additional proceeds as extra profit? Or raise the price half as much and profit that is, and pocket that as extra profit?
Not all the companies would.
Well, there's competition. There's competition. And when there's competition, that prevents the sellers from exploiting inelastic demand curves. The only way that sellers are able to exploit inelastic demand curves is if, for some reason, they do not have to worry about competition. And that would be the case if they have secret technology, so long as the secret holds, if they have a patent or copyright protection. But if they don't have patent or copyright protection or secret technology, then they're not in a position to exploit the inelastic demand. The price is going to be determined by the competition of sellers, and it will end up being set at a point not very far above the full costs of production. it'll be profitable, but not stupendously profitable. So the fact that there are numerous situations where the revenue of an industry might be greater, producing and selling a smaller quantity at a higher price, apart from the exceptions I've mentioned, sellers cannot take advantage of that. Now also, it's worth pointing out in this connection that under the freedom of competition, the elasticity of demand for the products of any particular company is far, far less under competition than the elasticity of demand for the products of the industry. We could have an extremely inelastic demand for the products of an industry, but if that item can be produced by more than one producer, the elasticity of demand confronting any individual producer will be radically less. Why? Because there are two elements to consider now. On the one side, as the price goes up, there may be very, very little reduction in quantity demanded of that sort of product. But at the same time, as the price goes up and makes the item's production more profitable, what can some other seller be doing? Producing and selling more. So now, even if it's the case, let's imagine if the price of my product goes up a dollar, let's assume nobody would stop buying. I raise my price, the price of a given product will be higher by a dollar, and no one will stop buying it. No one will even reduce the amount they buy. So the market would be willing to pay a dollar more for an unchanged quantity. But what happens if, as the price that I'm charging goes up a dollar, some other seller is willing to go on selling it at the same price, or raising it by less than a dollar, or someone else is now willing to sell it? What happens to my sales volume? My sales volume can decrease very, very sharply, because what's determining the elasticity of demand to me specifically as one seller out of more than one is not just the elasticity of demand for the product, but also the extent to which other sellers can expand their supply and sell in my place. So that can make the demand for me specifically highly elastic, while the demand for the industry is inelastic. And then, along these same lines, I'm sure there are many, many cases where items are sold under contract, and where contracts contain option clauses, where there are buyers who have the right to step up their purchases at a previously agreed upon contract price. So what would happen, I don't know if in fact this is the case in the distribution of cigarettes, but I wouldn't be surprised if it were. Suppose we have just a few major cigarette companies, a few major cigarette companies, but I'm sure they must have distributors, and suppose they have contracts with their distributors, which are tying the prices they charge to the distributors to the price of tobacco leaf. Suppose that's the case, and the distributors have the right to purchase a variable quantity at such a price. Well, what would happen if the cigarette companies tried to take advantage of the inelasticity of demand for cigarettes, but their distributors have the right to buy from them at a contractually agreed upon price, based perhaps on the price of tobacco leaf? Who would profit from the rise in price of cigarettes engineered by the tobacco companies? The distributors would make the profit. And so even though there were few tobacco companies, they wouldn't be in a position to profit by it. It's entirely possible you could have situations where there is only one producer, but if that one producer operates under contracts with his major customers, that one producer is deprived of the power to take advantage of an inelastic demand. So on the basis of such considerations, typically the elasticity of demand for the product of any one company is radically less than that for the industry as a whole in those cases in which the industry has an inelastic demand. And even where you have such things as copyright protection, you know, every newly published book, practically every newly published book is published under copyright. And there's no legal limit on what the publishers could charge for any given title. Well, because the books come out under copyright, they charge a higher markup than they would if the books didn't have copyright. But typically, they don't even know what the elasticity of demand for a given title is. And how could you actually know? Here you are, you're introducing a new novel. How would you even know what the elasticity is? You really can't know. And where you can't really know, the sensible thing to do is, well, you charge a higher markup, a premium markup, and then you go for the best volume you can. You try to get the best volume you can at a high markup. But you're really not in a position to judge would a particular title yield you more at a 20% higher price. You don't have the ability to establish such a thing. Yes, Ms. Fox?
Would you be able to do that, though, if it's like a sequel to a book or even to a movie, where you know that the book was a hit?
Well, I would say conceivably, maybe that would induce you to have a somewhat higher markup. You might think, okay, we have this mass audience. This was a runaway bestseller. So now we're coming out with the sequel. Maybe we'll get a higher markup than we did before. So if your markup initially was 20%, maybe now you'll go for 30%. But you're really not in a position to know what the elasticity of demand is. And in such cases, I think the rule followed is you charge a premium markup, and you try to go for the highest volume you can at the premium markup. And that will be very, very profitable if you get a high volume. All right, well, I'm obliged to give a mention to income and cross elasticity. These are two further variants on the concept. Income elasticity is the attempt to relate changes in the quantity demanded of a product, percentage changes in the quantity demanded of a product, to percentage changes in people's income. So if we were trying to contemplate the income elasticity of automobiles, we'd be attempting to determine by what percent will the quantity demanded of automobiles increase if people's incomes increase on an average 5%. Cross-elasticity of demand is the attempt to relate the percentage change in the quantity demanded of one product to a percentage change in the price of another. So we might attempt to relate the percentage change in the quantity demanded of lamb to a percentage change in the price of pork. That would be an example of cross-elasticity. In my opinion, these are over-elaborations of the concept. But you'll find them in all the textbooks. A couple of further points are needed to keep in mind in connection with elasticity. And in fact, with any quantitative element in economics, you should never confuse economics with engineering or physics. In engineering and physics, you have all kinds of tables of constants. There's a table of the specific gravities of all the different elements. There are tables of tensile strength of the different elements and compounds. And these are fixed constant magnitudes. We have all sorts of things like this in physics and engineering. There are no such constant magnitudes in economics. We do not have such a thing as, oh yeah, the elasticity of potatoes, that's minus 0.13. The elasticity of demand for gasoline, that's minus 0.05 or whatever. There are no such constants, and the elasticity of demand, elasticity varies over one and the same demand curve. You'll have a different elasticity at different points on the same demand curve. You can see how elasticity changes. When something is a luxury good, a fall in its price that opens up a mass market will operate to make the demand for that good highly elastic. But suppose now the price has fallen very substantially and the good is now an item of mass consumption and the market has been very, very heavily supplied. Say with automobiles, we're at the point where many, many families own two or even three automobiles, and there aren't very many families that don't yet have an automobile. In that kind of environment, what would you expect to have happened to the elasticity of the demand for automobiles? It would be sharply less. It might be much, much less. So the demand for one and the same good, it can be highly elastic at one part of the demand curve and much less elastic or inelastic on another part of the demand curve. Yes, Mr. Underwood.
Couldn't you, I mean, if you take an automobile, for example, I mean, you have almost 100 years of data, mm-hmm. and you have 100 years of market condition. Wouldn't it be possible to estimate what those elasticity would be on a given point on the demand curve?
All right, because we have 100 years of data, would it be possible to estimate the elasticity? And we could have a historical record showing what's happened over time, but this would reflect countless changes of all kinds going on in the economy. It would not be telling you what would happen as the result of a given change in price, all other things being equal.
I mean, even if I took a given set of factors, if I took inflation or GDP, various factors like that compared to the sales?
Well, you see, the demand for anything depends on so many different variables. Like, suppose we had not had major improvements in the highway system. Would that have had no impact on the elasticity of demand for automobiles? I think it does. Anything, things like the ability to change the oil every 3,000 miles instead of every 1,000 miles. All kinds of things can impact the demand for something and the elasticity of demand. So these things just aren't constants. There are other things equal in a world in which all sorts of things are continually changing. Okay, let me turn to supply curves. And here, my first point, when we're dealing with supply, the basic case in supply is a vertical line reflecting a given quantity that sellers are prepared to sell at the best price they can obtain. I describe this as the Austrian view of demand and supply, and this would also be the classical economist's view of supply. The sellers have a certain amount that they possess and are willing to sell, and that amount is indicated by a vertical line. And they'd be willing to sell it, if necessary, from any price, from zero on up to the sky. And the actual resulting price is determined by the limitation of the supply in conjunction with the demand. And I think this is the basic underlying case with respect to the influence of supply on prices. Now, typically, however, when supply curves are drawn, they are almost always drawn as sloping upward and to the right, the way I displayed that supply curve earlier tonight, sloping up and to the right. And there are a variety of reasons advanced for the supply curve sloping up and to the right. One such reason, which might seem very plausible, is applying marginal utility to the side of sellers. This is what I refer to under A, the marginal utility of sellers. And here, the way the argument could be developed, let's imagine we have a farmer with five horses, and he attaches marginal utility to each of his horses. It would be similar to the five sacks of grain. He indispensably requires one horse to be able to do his plowing. With two horses, he can do it better, and on down. So now, if this farmer is asked to part with one horse, what kind of price will have to be offered? The price will have to exceed the marginal utility of the fifth horse, right? Okay, but suppose our farmer is asked to part with a second horse. Then the price has to exceed the greater marginal utility of the second horse, right? Horse number four instead of horse number five. So if as the farmer has fewer horses, his marginal utility is rising, what does that suggest about the price that needs to be paid to induce the seller to part with his supply? It should go up, okay? And that would seem like a plausible basis for price having to rise to induce additional supplies. Now, actually, I don't think that reason holds outside of exceptional cases. Stop and consider for a moment, to what extent is the marginal utility that sellers attach to their supplies any kind of significant factor in a division of labor society where the total supply of the whole economy is produced by a relative handful of producers? I suppose we look at old Henry Ford, and the Ford Motor Company is turning out 1 million automobiles. Well, to how many of those 1 million automobiles would old Henry Ford possibly attach any kind of personal marginal utility? How many automobiles could old Ford personally use in the most generous imaginable way? Pardon me?
One?
I mean, I can use more than one. You can have a stable full. I mean, there was an actor some years ago, I think he's dead now quite a while, named Peter Sellers. If I'm not mistaken, he had a collection of maybe 40 automobiles or something like that. Sometimes there are people like that. Well, maybe Ford would have wanted one model, at least one of each model that the Ford Motor Company produced in every variation. So maybe that would be 100 cars. Or take the same principle, how many copies of Office 2003 could Bill Gates possibly attach personal marginal utility to? Maybe as a mansion, I don't know how many rooms are in the mansion. Perhaps there's a computer in each and every room with its own separate copy of Office 2003, and maybe has several different homes. So he might personally have a use for 100, 200 copies. But how many do they sell in a year? Probably millions. So the personal marginal utility of the sellers in a division of labor economy is no longer a factor. So that it falls by the wayside. Nevertheless, supply curves will typically slope upward, at least in partial markets, in localized markets. But the reason that they slope upward is on the basis of the overall limitation of supply, the supply being some given amount, at least for some time. And what makes the partial supply curve slope upward is, as I put it in point B, it's a case of riding up other demand curves. The basic case is a fixed supply, but even with the total supply fixed, there can be a variability of supply in any given market. I don't know if you guys can see this in the back. Maybe I can enlarge it once more. All right. What we have here is we're looking at the overall total market for something. We're breaking it down into two partial markets. Now, in reality, there could be hundreds of partial markets. To give this reality, think of a market for gasoline in New York and another market for gasoline in Chicago, or markets for wheat in different locations. There are many, many commodities that have markets in more than one location. There can be various markets for different products of the same factor of production. There's a market for gasoline, there's a market for diesel fuel, there's a market for jet fuel, and these all represent alternative uses for crude oil. We may have a limited supply of crude oil at any given time, but that doesn't stop more crude oil from being devoted to gasoline and less crude oil from being devoted to heating oil. Or more wheat going to one market and less to another. Well, let's initially deal with just two markets. We have, we'll call them market one and market two, and we have demand in each market. The overall total demand is the sum of these two. But we're looking at demand in each of two markets. Now, even though the overall total supply is given, for the time being at any rate, any one partial market could have a bigger supply. How? What would be needed for any partial market to have a bigger part of the overall total supply? In physical terms, let's say the grand total supply is 100 units. Market 2 could conceivably have 0 units and all 100 go to market 1, or market 2 could have 1 unit and market 1 99, or any combination, right? So where can one partial market obtain a bigger supply given a limitation of the overall total supply?
More capital.
I thought I just gave you the answer.
From the supply of the other.
From the supply of the other partial market. So if all 100 are initially in market 1 and none are in market 2, what would enable market 2 to gain a supply of 5, to increase its supply by 5, from 0 to 5?
Decrease
in
market 1.
If market 1's supply fell from 100 to 95, and market 2 could have 10 if market 1's supply fell further down to 90, and on and on. You could have 100 partial markets with the overall total supply representing any possible distribution, and any one partial market could have a bigger supply by drawing parts of the supply from the other partial markets. So do you see how any one market could have a bigger share of even of a fixed given overall total supply? Okay, now in each of these markets, we have a demand curve. Now, if we want to have a supply in market one, here we are, this would be a zero supply. Supply, here's supply quantity in market two, it could be zero. If it's zero in market two, then what's the supply in market one? The entire, I assume the total supply is 200. So if it's zero in one, it would in two, it would be 200 in one. But to find buyers for the whole 200 in market one, where would the price have to be? Does this read five or six? I can't be sure. $5? Okay, yes, $5. All right, now, so if the price were $5 in market one, the quantity demanded would equal the total supply. But, and that means in market two, there's no supply. Market two could gain 50 units, but if it gained 50 units, how much would be left in market one? 150, and what would those units sell for back in market one?
Six.
Okay, now that means that market two can get 50 units, but it has to outbid the buyers in market one. It would have to pay more than $5. If it pays up to $6, that should release these 50 units from market one. Now what about getting 75 units into market two? If 75 units are going to be in market two, what does that leave for market one? 125 over here. Now, if there are only 125 units in market one, what will they sell for?
Seven.
Okay, in order to get the 75 units into market two, why would market two have to be able and willing at least to pay $7 a unit? Yeah, they're competing. Market two and market one are in competition with one another. And in order to get the supply into market two, away from market one, the buyers in market two have to outbid the buyers in market one. Now, they can get, see, if we trace out the kind of price they have to pay to get larger quantities into market two, what path is being laid out here? What's it look like to get the larger quantities into market two? It's an upward sloping supply curve, right? Well, what's generating the upward sloping supply curve? What's generating it is that as we get a larger supply, we are riding up a downward sloping demand curve. In order, with no supply, here's the price in market two, in market one, rather. If we want to get 50 units, well, we have to go from here up to here. We have to raise the price up to $6. We have to raise the bid from 5 up to 6 to get 50 units into market one. We have to raise it up to 7 to get 75 units. If we wanted to get still more, we'd have to keep coming up higher and higher. Of course, we need to outbid more and more intense demands. So any given partial market can have a bigger supply by outbidding other partial markets. And in that process, what you're doing is riding up the downward sloping demand curve of the other markets. As you withdraw supply from a market, the price is getting higher in the market where there's less supply. And in order to get that supply, you have to be matching the rise in price. So I think this is an explanation of upward sloping supply curves when the basic case with respect to supply is that supply is a given at least for some time. Now, there can be yet further bases for deriving an upward sloping supply curve, but they would be confined, I think, basically to the case of agriculture and mining, and they entail the law of diminishing returns and that accompanying element, the need to resort to land and mines of inferior quality. If we want to have a larger supply of agricultural commodities and minerals, well, under what conditions would a larger supply of agricultural commodities be produced given the state of technology and supply of capital equipment? We discussed the underlying principle, I believe, Saturday, if I'm not mistaken. No, if not, maybe last Monday, perhaps. what principle did we discuss applicable especially to agriculture and mining that would explain why, as we wanted to increase the production of something in those industries, we might expect a higher price?
Would that be the law of diminishing marginal utility?
I thought you were going to have it. The law of diminishing returns. The law of diminishing returns. If to expand production we encounter diminishing returns, what does that imply about the cost of production? That it's higher. If to expand production we need to resort to lands and mines that are inferior, what's that imply about the cost of production? That's higher. Now, you'd have a basis for this also in industry, to the extent that at a given time there may be different grades of capacity in use or available. Yes, Mr.
In the example you just mentioned, how does the economies of scale affect, for example?
Excuse me?
In the example you just provided, how does the economies of scale impact?
What about economies of scale?
Of scale, for example, if you just produce more and more of the cost goes down.
Okay.
Then after a certain point, then it goes up.
So. All right, Kumar is raising a very good question pertaining to economies of scale, under which when we produce on a larger scale, costs go down. Well, that obviously would not be a basis of rising supply curves.
Okay.
And sometimes in textbooks, you'll find the supply curve drawn downward sloping, reflecting economies of scale. Hopefully, we'll be able to deal with that a little bit further shortly. But at the moment, I'm trying to develop the possible bases of supply curves rising. And I think the most important basis is the competition of different partial markets for the same limited supplies. So any one partial market wanting more has to outcompete other markets along riding up their demand curves. As they have less supply, the value of those diminished supplies is greater and greater because they're at a higher point on the demand curve. But then in addition, there's the possibility of the operation of diminishing returns and the need to resort to land and mines of inferior quality. And then also within industry, at any given time, there can be different grades of capacity. And we can imagine that there are many plants that have some of the newest, most recent, most efficient capacity. That's part of their capacity. Other things being equal, that would have the lowest costs of operation. Then there's somewhat older, less efficient capacity that would have a higher cost of operation. Then still older, still less efficient capacity with a still higher cost. Now, to the extent that this is so, and let's try to put some numbers on it. If we view a firm's entire capacity, let's break it up into three different categories. Suppose 20% of their capacity is the newest, most efficient. A further 60% of their capacity is not so efficient, but not bad. And then, so that represents a total of 80%. Then they have a remaining 20% of capacity that is still older and less efficient. Well, what happens if the demand for their products falls to the point where they're now operating below 80% of overall capacity? Which part of their capacity will they make idle?
The 20%.
The most expensive 20%, right?
Yes.
And they'll operate the most efficient 20%, that they'll be fully operating. And if they operate at 70%, rather than 80%, well, that further reduction comes at the expense of the middling capacity. Well, what would have to happen if this firm's operations were to expand and it were to go from 75% of capacity to 85% of capacity? What would be the effect on its level of operating costs? That would increase because it would have to bring in capacity of the third quality, so to speak. It would be analogous to the situation with lands of different degrees of productivity. So to the extent that that situation exists, you'd have a basis for supply curves sloping upward also. Now, in point four, I refer to the confusion between cost of production and supply and demand as the determinant of price. And point A, I refer to a horizontal supply curve, which I think is the most common case prevailing throughout manufacturing and retailing. Let's try to look at that. Hopefully, yeah, here we are. All right, this would be a horizontal supply curve. And what this is showing is the sellers are prepared to offer a highly variable quantity at this given price. Whatever this price may be over here, the sellers are prepared to offer a supply ranging from here out to here. And I think this is very, very typical. Just think for a moment, when you go into a restaurant or a barber shop, a department store, or an automobile showroom, almost any retail operation, is it the case that the sellers are prepared to offer some unique supply at a unique price? How many steak dinners is a restaurant prepared to provide at the price on its menu? As many steaks as they have, and what's going to determine how many they actually do provide? How many people order the steak? What's going to determine how many haircuts a barbershop provides at the price listed on its wall board? How many customers come in asking for haircuts? And what determines how many computers Dell sells at the price it's advertising in the newspapers and magazines? How many automobiles the automobile dealers and manufacturers will deliver at the prices they're advertising? It's the quantities demanded. So I would say what's really present here in cases like this, which are very, very common, perhaps more common, I think more common than the upward sloping supply curve case. What's determining the actual quantity supplied is the quantity demanded at the prices being asked. The actual sequence is the sellers are asking certain prices. At those prices, the public is responding by buying or not buying, and the extent to which the public is buying at these prices, that's determining the quantities that the sellers actually sell. Now, we could draw a demand curve. We could say, okay, well, here's the demand curve. Here's the demand curve. And the demand curve and the supply curve intersect, and here's the price. And we could say, okay, the price is being determined by demand and supply. But if the demand curve shifted out to here, what would happen to the price? It would stay the same. Or if the demand curve were here, the price would be the same. So even though we can make it fit the formula and pattern of supply and demand determining the price, the real significant issue is, why is this price line right here? Why is it here rather than here or here? See, in cases of this kind, I think the formula that demand and supply are determining the price is simplistic. It's really not getting to the heart of what's going on. I think in these cases, the prices in the first instance are set by the sellers, but set on the basis of what main consideration?
Cost.
I would say it's cost of production. Not necessarily their own cost, though in many cases it is. In many cases, if you believe that your costs are the same costs that virtually everybody else has, and they're not in a position to undercut you without taking losses, well, then it might be good sense to base your price directly on your own cost. Or if you know what the prices being charged by others are, you may just have to set your price to match theirs. Maybe you would have to set it a little bit higher if you think you have a premium product, that, and so a premium price is justified by your premium product. Or maybe you think you have a sort of schlocky product and you better sell it at a discount. In these cases, the immediate underlying determinant would still be the seller's setting price based on consideration of cost of production. And I think in such cases, only in appearance is the price determined by the intersection of supply and demand curves. The underlying element is cost of production. And again and again, if you have a large efficient firm, if there's a large efficient firm in an industry that has capacity to spare, that's not working at the limit of its capacity by any means, the price that is set may well be one that is geared to the higher costs of production of less efficient competitors. It could pay to set a price that doesn't drive the less efficient competitors out of business, but doesn't let them grow rich either, so they can't become any kind of significant threat. And you set a price not too far above their cost of production, and you attempt to make high profits to the extent you can achieve lower costs of production. But what would be still governing the price would be cost of production. Why would the other firms not be able to get a higher price, except to the extent they had some premium quality? Because you have idle capacity, you're in a position to take away their customers if they charge a higher price. So long as you have capacity to spare, they can't charge a higher price unless it's justified by some premium in quality, because they'll lose too much business to you. And why can't they charge a lower price?
You can afford to lower your prices.
Because the price is already set at the point where they're not making very much money. They'd have to take a loss to do it, and you can meet that price. You have lower costs than they do. So I think that's what would govern it. Now then also, there's the case raised by Kumar, the economies of scale. And in such a case, you have, if you were drawing it as a supply curve, you have a downward sloping supply curve, meaning that as the output expands, the unit costs are actually diminishing. Now, in such a case, it may well be that as the scale of operations expands, the price will be lowered. And what would be a rationale for lowering the price as your costs fell and the quantity demanded increased?
Well,
pardon me?
Increase your sales.
Well, you'd have greater sales. But also, isn't this the best possible protection against competition? If here you are, you're achieving very low costs, and those who are going to attempt to compete against you will have to at least start off with substantially higher costs, and they won't be able to make money at the prices you're charging. Well, isn't that the best way of guaranteeing your market? You'd be influenced again by considering what are potential new entrance costs, and if you can price below new entrance costs and do so significantly and still be very profitable yourself, well, that's the best kind of guarantee of keeping your market and keeping a very profitable business. Now here, you might be the only supplier, but you're maintaining your position not by charging high prices, but by charging low prices at which you can be profitable and no one else can be. Okay. Well, I'm going to, in the interests of time, unless there are any specific questions on any of these other points, I'd like to jump ahead to the next major subject in price theory, which is the uniformity of profit principle. So let me pause, give you a chance, if you have any questions you want to ask, to please do so. Yes, Mr. Severin?
Oh, no, I'm just going to simply ask, is that the next supplemental reading?
No, yeah, number four.
Number four?
Yeah, okay. Hopefully you all got my email urging you to bring in supplement four. Okay, well, let me present this principle. This I consider to be a really profound, major economic principle. It goes back at least as far as Adam Smith. And this is the principle that the rate of profit, or equivalently rate of return, on capital invested tends, I should perhaps have some way of doubly emphasizing tends, tends toward uniformity in all branches of industry, in all branches of the economic system. Let me ask if anyone would care to explain the difference between the rate of profit, rate of return on capital invested, and a profit margin. That's that first point. Would anyone, is anyone confused about that?
What would the rate of profit, capital invested?
The distinction between the rate of profit on capital invested and a profit margin.
The rate of profit is just your sale, your revenue minus your costs, right?
Well, the amount of profit is revenue minus costs. That's the amount of profit. What's the rate of profit, or equivalently, rate of return on capital invested?
Your net sales of your assets.
Net sales?
Yes.
Well, pardon me?
Wouldn't it be profit?
The profit over the capital invested. The profit divided by the capital invested. That's the rate of profit, or equivalently, the rate of return on capital. What is a profit margin in contrast?
Sales price minus. It's a question of the difference between the cost versus the sales price.
Well, sales minus cost is profit, but what is a profit margin?
Your cost over the percentage of the cost versus the sales.
Well, that would be a cost margin, one could say, but what's a profit margin?
Your net divided by your profit over the cost, actually.
You're close. Profit over sales. A profit margin is profit divided by sales. That's the profit margin. Profit relative to sales. Now, this principle that the rate of return on capital tends toward uniformity in all the different branches of production does not mean that profit margins tend toward uniformity. We can have very, very different profit margins accompanying the same rate of profit. Hopefully this will open before the period ends. I don't know why. Okay, here we go. We have a rate of profit, i.e. profit divided by capital, abbreviated P over K. And a profit margin is profit divided by sales, P over S. And then there's a third item, the capital turnover ratio, which is sales divided by capital. Now, different industries have very different profit margins, but also very different capital turnover ratios. And I give an example of three different sorts of industries with different profit margins, different capital turnover ratios, but which are tending to earn the same rate of profit on capital invested. So we have supermarkets. I think a typical profit margin in a supermarket is on the order of 2%. They're only making about 2 cents on the dollar of sales as profit. But how rapidly does their capital turn over in a year? How many times can they earn that 2% and apply it to capital? If their sales are five times their capital, imagine a supermarket has $10 million in capital with $50 million in sales, and they're making 2% on the $50 million. Well, 2% on $50 million is $1 million, and $1 million divided by the $10 million of capital, that's 10%. Now, then there's something like the automobile industry. The automobile industry has a much slower capital turnover ratio than the supermarket industry. So if its capital turnover ratio is on the order of 1 to 1, meaning that its sales in a year only equal its capital, well, then the automobile industry needs a 10% profit margin to earn a 10% rate of profit. An electric utility whose sales in a year might only be half of the total capital invested, it would need a 20% profit margin to earn 10% on its capital. Now, if you stop for a moment and consider why are these capital turnover ratios so different, well, just think, what is some significant part of the capital of a supermarket invested in, and how quickly do they turn it?
Perishables?
I mean, perishable goods. They may be buying in a wholesale market at 4 a.m. in the morning and sell most of those goods that they bought that morning before the close of business that day. So if they do that every day, that part of their capital is turning over 365 times in a year. You can make a very slim profit margin if you do it 365 times. Now, that's not all of their capital. That's only a part. Their capital in canned goods turns less rapidly. And then they have capital in fixtures and freezers in the building that the supermarket occupies. And when you take it all together, it may work out that the capital turnover ratio is 5. In the automobile industry, there's nothing that corresponds to the quick turnover of produce or dairy products or anything of that kind. The automobile company has warehouses of materials before they're brought into the production process. There's some time that goes by. Time goes by in fabricating the cars from beginning to end. Further time before the cars are shipped. Further time before they reach the dealers. Further time before they're paid for. And then, of course, they have this huge investment in heavy equipment and in the factory buildings. And so their turnover is lower. And with the electric utilities, you have the huge investments in the generating stations and then in the power lines. Okay, so we're saying there's this tendency toward a uniform rate of profit on capital invested, which would be accompanied by permanently unequal profit margins counterbalanced by unequal capital turnover ratios. Now, why is there this principle? What gives rise to it? Well, to see the operation of this principle, we can start with the assumption that rates of profit in the different branches of the economy are unequal, and at any given time, they almost always are. So at any given time, we have an array of rates of profit. There are some industries incurring losses. There are others earning only very modest rates of profit. And then there are others that are earning very high rates of profit. Okay, so we have a wide disparity existing at any given time between rates of profit in different branches of industry. But which kind of rate of profit does an investor prefer? A positive or negative rate, or a higher or lower rate?
A higher positive rate.
A higher positive rate. They definitely don't want losses. They want profits, and other things being equal, they want higher profits, higher rates of profit, rather than lower rates of profit. So beginning with an inequality, let's say this left hand of mine represents high rates of profit, this right hand represents low rates, investors prefer these rates. And to the extent that they're in a position to change their pattern of investment, to the extent they're invested in relatively low profit returns, what will they be attempting to do as far as they can? To shift their capital, withdraw capital from the loss-making or low-profit lines of investment and invest it in the high-profit lines. So in response to these unequal rates of return, capital is going to move from the low-profit areas to the high-profit areas. And as that happens, what is the effect of the investment of additional capital in the initially high-profit lines on the size of production of the high-profit items? What happens to the supply? What will have to happen to find additional buyers for the additional supply? And what will be the effect of that on price, on profit margins, and on rates of profit in the initially high rate of profit industries?
Supplies go up.
Prices would tend to come down, and profit margins down, and the rate of profit down. Okay, and as capital is withdrawn from the loss-making and low-profit lines, what happens to their ability to produce? That goes down. What will happen to the ability to sell the reduced output of these industries? The price and profit margin go up. The rate of profit goes up. So notice, in response to the inequality of profit, the incentive of the investors is to bring about a movement of capital from the loss-making and low-profit industries into the high-profit industries. And the effect of that movement of capital is to bring down the initially high-profit lines and raise up the initially low-profit lines. And the stopping point of this process, the only logical stopping point, would be an equalization of rates of return. Now, further, we should realize that capital is moved not just by the investors deciding they're going to withdraw their capital and move it over. The inequality in the rate of return itself is a source of transfer of capital. Because typically, what will be done with a large part of the high profits that are earned in the high profit industries? They'll be saved and reinvested. And so the high rates of profit themselves are the source of expanded investment. And what is the effect of losses on the capital invested in the loss-making industry? A loss comes out of what? When a company has a loss, what is it losing? Part of its capital. A loss directly slices away at capital, and even if they had some modest profit, if the profit that they're earning is not sufficient to cover the dividends that they're paying, then they have a decline of capital for that reason too. So high profits themselves are the source of new and additional capital, and low profits or losses are the source of capital being reduced. And then on top of that, there's the withdrawal of capital by investors and its deployment into other lines. So these are the reasons why there is this principle that in response to the inequality itself, a movement of capital occurs, which brings down the rate of profit in the industries into which it enters and raises up the rate of profit in the industries from which it's withdrawn. Now, this principle is of enormous importance in understanding the operation of the economic system. I say in point one, I refer to the harmonious balancing of the different branches of industry. You see, if you stop to think about it, as I pointed out before, everybody is acting for his own profit. People are investing in all different lines for their own profit. And many, many people have the reaction, well, this is an anarchy of production. It's chaos. And they think the only way to have order is if we had some government bureau in charge of the pattern of investment. Because the way things stand, legally, everybody could decide to invest in the same branch of business. Everyone has the legal right to invest in the shoe business. But what sorts of chaos would occur if too much capital is invested in certain lines and not enough in other lines? Well, you think that could be pretty chaotic. And if you didn't know about the uniformity of profit principle, you might think, well, all hell will break loose. Now everyone will pile into the shoe business and we won't have groceries. Or everyone will take it into his head to go into the grocery business and we'll be going barefoot. Now, conditions such as that have existed, but not in a capitalist market economy. They exist under socialism. In the old Soviet Union, at one time, you couldn't get toilet paper. Then you could get toilet paper, but not soap. There'd always be problems with something or other. You would have enormous chaos. Now, what stops chaos under capitalism is that the uniformity of profit principle is at work. Because suppose it does happen that too much capital is invested in some lines, not enough in other lines. How does that process operate to correct itself? Profits will decline in the in industries in which there's too much investment. Profits will rise in the lines where there's not enough investment. And as I put it in the same point, this represents incentives and also the means for the counteraction, the delimitation, and prevention of mistakes in production. So just think, to the extent that we have the mistake of relative overinvestment and overproduction, the consequence is low profits or losses, which has what effect on the investment of capital?
It's removed from that market.
It cuts it back down. And where we've had the mistake of underinvestment and underproduction, then there's a premium rate of profit, which provides both the incentive and also the means by saving out of the profit for stepped-up investment and production. So the system is self-correcting. Mistakes are made, but to the extent that they are, the consequences are low profits or losses in the overexpanded lines and premium profits in the underexpanded lines. And notice also, the bigger the mistakes, the more powerful become the counteracting forces of correction. If you have a mistake of relatively modest overinvestment and overproduction, well, that causes some decline in profits. But if it's a big mistake, you'll have a much bigger decline and losses. If you have a modest underinvestment, well, there'll be some premium in profit. But if it's a bigger mistake, it'll be a much bigger premium, providing more powerful incentive and more rapid accumulation of means for expansion. This is under the head of delimitation of the mistakes. The bigger the mistake, the harder it is to make, because the counteracting forces of correction are more powerful. And then, of course, there's this further point that most of the mistakes that might have been made are prevented from the very beginning. Because what are investors seeking to do as far as they can determine in advance? What investments are they looking for? What investments are they seeking to avoid? Yeah, they're trying to invest in the most profitable lines. They want to avoid loss-making investments. So as far as they can, they try to stay away from anything they think will be over-invested in and to go into those lines which they think are otherwise unprovided, or insufficiently provided for. Yes, Mr. Feldman.
Would this principle apply to the dot-com curse with all the money and investments that were going in, and then it kind of corrected itself when companies started to fail?
Well, it did ultimately correct itself, but I would say the dot-com phenomenon or any kind of boom is something that would not normally arise. It arises because of a major disturbance introduced into the economy from outside, particularly in the form of credit expansion. See, when the government and the banking system create new and additional money, it appears as though there's new and additional capital. But there really isn't. There's just new and additional money. And when this new and additional money enters the stock market, it can make the appearance of new and additional capital seem really huge. I think that what fueled the whole stock market bubble was the fact that there were substantial amounts of new and additional money being created, and they were getting introduced into the stock market. Let's say a corporation wants to take over another corporation to buy its stock, and if it could do that by obtaining bank loans, which were created out of new and additional money, well, let's say here's a company, it borrows newly created money, it buys shares in the target company. What will the stockholders do in the target company who've now sold their shares? What will they be doing with practically all of the money they've received?
Buy some other stocks.
They'll buy other stocks. So now there's a rise in the demand for and prices of other stocks. What will the sellers of those stocks be doing with the new and additional money they've received?
Buy
other stocks. And then so long as new and additional money is coming into the market, it's like bullets racing around from stock to stock, raising prices. Now, but whenever the process stops, you see, some of this money that initially goes into the stock market is always coming out. As the stocks go up, people feel they're getting richer. And to the extent they do, what sorts of goods will they be induced to buy now? They'll buy various luxury goods. So some money is leaving the market to do that. As stock prices go up sharply, firms contemplating any kind of expansion, they always have the alternative, should they expand by buying up some other company, getting its assets, or building new assets. Well, as the price of stocks go up out of sight, how is that decision being influenced? Well, I think to build some new capacity. So this represents money coming out of the stock market, and unless fresh new additional money keeps pouring in, what's going to happen is there'll be money leaving, and will it be possible to maintain the level of stock prices? Now you see, the money that's jacking them up is largely in transition to the rest of the economy, and the rise can be maintained only so long as fresh money keeps coming in. And to have further rises, you need to accelerate the money coming in. Well, this went on for some years, but ultimately the Federal Reserve became alarmed, because if they were going to try to keep this up indefinitely, there'd have to be more and more money coming into the stock market. There'd be more and more money getting diffused throughout the whole economy. This would be the basis, this would be a substantial inflation. So what did they do? They raised interest rates, which the real significance of which was to sharply curtail the inflow of new and additional money. The significance of the higher interest rates is that the infusion of new money into the economy is curtailed. That's how they achieved the rise in interest rates. But when the infusion of new money was curtailed, that pulled the bottom out from under the market. So I would say that phenomenon was not normal mistakes in investment. People were suddenly made to believe that they possessed vastly more capital overnight. So many people thought they're so rich, and your scale of economic activity is profoundly influenced by how much capital you think you have. And so a level of activity that was generated that really didn't have an objective foundation. And then when the plug was pulled, all of that collapsed. Yes, Mr. Kahn.
Would that same concept actually apply to the current real estate market?
Would that apply to the current real estate market? I think so, yes. We've had this huge run-up in real estate prices, fueled by very low mortgage interest rates, which means that the monthly payments on a bigger loan are no greater than they used to be on a smaller loan at a high interest rate. And people have felt enabled to pay huge prices for houses. But what will happen if and when mortgage rates have a significant rise? And here we are, we have people who've bought homes for $1 million or more. How will buyers be able to meet payments if they have to get mortgages at significantly higher rates than prevail today? Well, if there was some sudden dramatic rise in income levels, they could do it. But with today's level of incomes, which aren't going up very much, if you suddenly would have to pay a 6 or 7% mortgage rate instead of 5 or whatever it's been, could you afford to pay the same kind of price for a home that someone has who's gotten a very low mortgage interest rate?
No.
So I think it means there'll be a lot of people who paid very high prices for houses who for quite some time won't be able to find buyers able to finance the size of mortgages needed to pay that kind of price. So I would expect that real estate prices should take a significant tumble sometime ahead. It's a question of when. Yes, Mr. Trexler, is it? Yes.
When you say that the producers of the houses are basically, they're basically overproducing, so they're going to experience losses.
I would think they well could. You see, they're being induced to step up their production because these low interest rates are stimulating the demand for housing, and it filters back to the construction materials industry, anything connected with housing construction. And so had we not had that, we wouldn't have had the degree of expansion in those lines. And if and when this process stops, they're going to be shown to have gone too far. They'll be relatively overexpanded.
Isn't there a difference, though, between the two vehicles, like in the stock market, and basically it's paper that we're dealing with versus the real estate market? You know, if there is a collapse, there's still real estate actually supporting, you know, that that pricing.
Well, there is real estate, but the question is, what you see in the companies, there are also physical assets too. But the financial requirement is that the value of the thing not drop to the point of wiping the owner out. So you'll still have the land is certainly going to be there. The house will almost certainly be there. But if you've borrowed a substantial amount, let's say you bought $1 million house, and I don't know what kind of equity requirements were in force. Were they still requiring 20% down? Or my understanding is things got much relaxed. What did you have to put down to buy a house in the last few years?
I mean, some cases in 0%.
Some cases 0%. Okay. Well, then suppose the value of the property falls 2%. That's not much. What's happened to your equity? It's minus 2%. And even if you had some significant equity, if you had 10% equity, if the price declines more than 10%, you're wiped out. You're in negative territory. So that's what happened in the dot-com bubble, too. I mean, there were still assets there, but their value declined, and the equity owners and many of the creditors were just wiped out. Okay, I see we're almost at our limit. So I'll just make my final point here that it's significant that in a market economy, at any given time, most of the capital is in the possession of people who have a proven track record. If you've made significant bad investments in the past, what's happened to your capital?
It's gone.
you've lost it. And so you're not in much position to determine the pattern of investment any longer. Most of those who have significant capital, this would be apart from recent heirs, if you've had significant capital, you've had to make profitable investments. That's how you accumulated your capital. So you need to have a good track record. So most of the capital at any given time is in the hands of people who have a demonstrated track record in successful investing. And that's an added reason why mistakes are held down. They're held in limits because the investors have the incentives. They're trying to avoid the mistake of overproduction, rectify anybody else's mistake of underinvestment, underproduction. And they've demonstrated some degree of skill at it in the past. Okay, next week we'll go further with this. I think there's an awful lot of valuable consequences to understand here. So have a very good week, and I'll see you next week.